Jewish Audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad, South London, England.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to part 15 of our course on Jewish history. Last week, we spoke about the establishment of the Jewish colonies in Spain, and this week, we're not actually going to focus on any specific area as we did last week. However, this week we're going to look at great people, the great people who lived in the 11th and 12th centuries, the luminaries of the Jewish world. We did mention last week the establishment of a yeshiva in Spain by Reb Moshe ben Chanoich. If you will remember, there were the four rabbis on the ship who got accosted by the pirates, and they were sold to different areas of the world, one to North Africa, one in Egypt, and Reb Moshe ben Chanoch was sold and established a yeshiva in Cordova. And in fact, then there started the most significant era and development of Talmudic codification and learning, which took place in Spain, as we already discussed last week. However, one thing which we did not discuss, and that was, how did the codification of the Talmud change? Let me explain what I mean. When we studied the period of the creation of the Talmud in the Babylonian era, we mentioned that hundreds of people put it together. It was finally edited by Mar Baravashi. And the Talmud is a most meandering work. It starts with a quote from the Mishnah, and then you'll have sometimes 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 pages of Talmudic comment, source material, anecdotes, history, law, disputes, quoting conflicting baraisos, things which were excluded from the Mishnah, tosefta, additions which were not included in the Mishnah, resolving those disputes, sometimes not coming to a clear resolution. And for the layman, it is a minefield. For the scholar, the Garden of Eden. And at this period, in the 11th and 12th centuries, this issue was addressed by the great Jews of Spain. They felt that now, more than ever, what was necessary was to sift through the vast amount of Talmudic information and to coalesce from it, to distill from it, a guide of halakha, of Jewish law. And the first gentleman who came along to do this was a man by the name of Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yaakov. He was born in the year 1013 in the town of Fez in North Africa, and he became to be known as Al-Fazi after the town of Fez. He studied there and subsequently in Kairouan, which is a town which I mentioned to you, is North Africa. That was where Rabbeinu Nissim and Rabbeinu Hananel were stationed. That was in fact one of the towns where one of these four rabbis was in fact sold. It was a great yeshiva there. And after he'd studied under the greats in the town of Kairouan, he returned to Fez and stayed as the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the Talmudic Academy in Fez, for 40 years. And during that stay in Fez, he wrote what came to be called as the Halachos of the Rif. The Rif, standing for Rabbeinu Yitzchak Al-Fazi, or from Fez. And what he did, in fact, it became such a major work that today, in every reprinting of the Talmud, this summary of Law of the Rif is appended to each volume of the Talmud. What he did is, in the order of the Talmud, he sifted through the structure and he precipitated or distilled the final law. And he wrote, therefore, a summary of the law of the Talmud in the order of the Talmud, on the Talmud, and produced his work. He also, of course, conferred and with the other great Jewish leaders of his time, and this distillation of the Rif became an extremely important halachic work, because students of the Talmud would read through the Talmud and some of its commentaries, and then they would look at the Rif to find how the Rif ruled the law. In the year 1088, he in fact moved from Fez to Spain, and he became the Rosh Hashiva in Lucena in Spain, and he there taught many students, two of whom, one of called Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, of whom we will shortly speak about, became his greatest students. He died in the year 1103, age 90, which is in fact a ripe old age in his times. And just to give you the correct chain of tradition, the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchok Alfasi, is one of his great students, was Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash, or the Ri Migash, as is known in the Talmudic world. And one of the greatest students of the Ri Migash was Reb Maimon, and of course the son of Reb Maimon was Reb Moshe ben Maimon, whom, of course, we shall talk about tonight, was the Rambam Maimonides. Let me just give you a snippet of information about the Rif, to be used later in the 16th century. The Code of Jewish Law, written by Reb Joseph Caro, who lived in Tzfas, in Israel, in the 16th century. How did he rule a law in the Code of Jewish Law? So he writes that he very much takes three pillars of teaching. One pillar being Maimonides, the other pillar being the Rosh, Rabbeinu Osher, and the other the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchok Alfasi, where all three of them agree, that is the ruling. Where two of them disagree against one of them, he rules like the majority. And where all three of them disagree, which is quite rare, then he will look towards other commentaries and rules in favour of the majority. It actually comes out, somebody once calculated, that over 70% of the rulings in the Code of Jewish Law in fact follow the ruling of Maimonides, of Rambam, which shows you how the Rambam, as we'll soon discuss later, was the most eminent scholar of the era. However, the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchok Alfasi, his contribution is inestimable, and in fact, even today, students of the Talmud, when they'll study the Talmud, they'll study the Talmud, the commentaries that explain the Talmud, and then if you want to become not just a Talmudist, but a Halachist, you'll move on to study the Rif and the Rambam. So it's an important work which is still studied today. In the year 1146, a fanatical sect of Muslims called the Almohades captured southern Spain. They moved from North Africa and captured southern Spain. And whereas the authorities until then had been very tolerant of the Jewish population, this fanatical sect was in fact the very opposite. They destroyed much Jewish property and shuls, and many hundreds of thousands of Jews who lived in southern Spain fled to more tolerant areas of Spain, particularly to the town of Toledo, which was then in the hands of the Christians, and it was in the province of Castile. And in fact, at that time, after 1146, many prominent Jews made their way to Toledo, and we find that many of the greatest poets and writers of the time were part of the fugitives that in fact fled southern Spain to find their way in other areas. In fact, quite early in 1085, there was a king called King Alfonso, who was the ruler of Castile. He had captured Toledo from the Muslims, and he did treat the Jews well for his own selfish reasons, whatever that was, because they would bring merchandise into the area. However, for whatever reason it was, the fact is that now a new Jewish establishment was settled, not so much in the southern areas of Spain, but more in the province of Castile, and particularly in the town of Toledo. Born in Toledo was another of the great Jewish luminaries of that day, and he was called Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. He studied in Lucina, which we mentioned beforehand, was the place where the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, was a Rosh Hashiva. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, at an early age, also mastered science and philosophy. His poetry, of which he is famed for, displays a phenomenal mastery of biblical literature. His poetry became the collective voice and mouthpiece of the Jewish soul in exile. It expresses an intense love of God and a yearning for redemption and a return to Zion. You may know that on Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, we recite Kinos, Book of Lamentations, and other prayers of lament. One of them is called Tzion Halo Tishali. In fact, there's a famous song, Tzion, 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 Halo Tishali. Tzion, Zion, Halo Tishali, will I not ask for you and look for you? This poem was written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and much of this piyut, of this poetry, was incorporated into the liturgy of the prayers which we say, in fact, on days like the 9th of Av, when we lament the destruction of the temple. However, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was famed not so much for his poetry and for the liturgy, which, as I said, has been incorporated very much into our prayer books and so on and so forth, but he was more famous for his masterpiece, for his magnum opus, for his great work called Kuzari. Now, we did in fact mention this book last week. The Kuzari is a book based on the story of a heathen kingdom of the Khazars. And we did mention this last week, that there was this kingdom, and the king of the Khazars asked a representative of the Christians, a representative of the Jews, and a representative of the Muslims to debate each other. And the book Kuzari is written in 5 parts, and it's a dialogue between the king of the Khazars and a chaver. A chaver means a friend, literally, or a Jewish sage who won the debate and who discusses basic aspects of Jewish philosophy with the king. The arguments produced in Kuzari are not based on philosophical foundations or rational proofs. Rather, they're based on historical perspective, on belief at the stand of Sinai, belief in revelation. They are proving, if you want, authenticity of the Torah from a traditional perspective, rather than from a philosophical perspective. Now, that is very important, because at the end of today's Shia, we will see that around this time in history, there grew a tremendous conflict within Jewish circles as to which aspect or which avenue should one explore Judaism, from a traditional point of view or from a rational philosophical point of view. And perhaps I'll make a comment about that a little later. The book ends, the book Kuzari ends by the Chaver, by the friend of the king of the Khazars, taking his leave of the king in order to go to Jerusalem, the place that of course he yearned for. Perhaps the end of the book is a reflection of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's true life desire, which was to return to Zion. And tradition has it that in real life Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, after ending his book Kuzari, left Spain, travelled through North Africa and Egypt, and finally reached the Holy Land. And when he entered into the Holy Land, into the land of Israel, as he was kneeling down to kiss the ground, tradition has it that an Arab horseman came along and killed him. That was the famous tradition of how the life of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi ended. Perhaps in itself, this picture of the great yearn for Zion, almost its fulfillment, almost kissing the land, and yet remaining in exile. Perhaps that encapsulates most pictorially the book Kuzari, and in fact much of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's work. However, one could say that he was one of the great Jewish poets of all time, one of the great contributors to liturgy and much of our Siddur and other works, and most of all the book Kuzari, which has been translated now into English in a number of editions, and is still widely read as one of the greatest philosophical Jewish works. I would in fact recommend everybody to read it. It is a fascinating work, even in from a modern perspective. Let us move on now to another great Jew of the era, a man called Reb Avraham Ibn Ezra. You may have heard of the Ibn Ezra as a great commentator on the Bible. He was born in the year 1092, grew greatly in the study of Talmud, and became a great Talmud Chacham, a great master of the Talmud. However, quite amazingly, he displayed a genius not only in Jewish subjects, but very widely in all the sciences of the time, in mathematics, in astronomy, in philosophy, in poetry. There wasn't, in fact, an art or a science which Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra didn't master. He spent the first half of his life in Spain, and in fact, the story goes that he never had any mazel. He never had any mazel, Ibn Ezra. He once wrote about himself that if I was to become a maker of candles, the sun would never set. And if I were to make shrouds, no one would ever die. He once wrote that about himself. I think I've often quoted to you the story of Ibn Ezra, but it's worth saying over again that he was very poor, and his congregants felt that it was incorrect that the rabbi should be so destitute, so they decided one day that they'll give him some money. However, they didn't feel it was bekavod, that it was honorable, just to give it to him in his hand, so they decided every single day the rabbi gets up in the morning and he walks the same path to the synagogue. So what they'll do is they'll put some money in a bag, and they'll place it on the pavement on the way to shul. The rabbi will come, he'll see the money, he'll obviously come to shul, he will announce and ask, has anybody lost this money? Nobody will claim it, and he'll keep it. Find his keepers, that is the law, if nobody claims it. And this is what they did. One morning, somebody put a sack of money on the in the road, and it says that the Ibn Ezra that morning woke up, and he opened his eyes, and he was filled with a great sense and deep sense of thanks to the Almighty that he has his eyesight. He was exhilarated at the fact that he could recognize different colors and shapes. And he knew that as the rabbi and as the chazan, he would lead the community in prayer. And of course, one of the prayers which we say every single day in the morning is the bracha. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Pekeach Ivrim, we thank God for opening the eyes of the blind. And he thought how terrible it would be if, God forbid, one didn't have any eyesight. How would it be even to walk to shul? And he decided that that day, in order to say the bracha, in order to say the blessing with gusto, that day he would walk to shul with his eyes closed. That is what happened, and of course he didn't find the mazel. He was a shalei mazel. He didn't have any mazel. He spent the first half of his life, as I said, in Spain. But the second half of his life, once he'd, in fact, gained some fame already, he became a traveller. And he travelled all throughout the world at that time. He went to the land of Israel, and he studied Kabbalah in the mystical city of Tzfat and also Tiberia. He went as far east as Babylon and stayed in Baghdad. He then came back to Italy and in fact travelled through Italy, Spain, southern France. He came to England, and there is a famous reference in his commentary to the Bible on the biblical passage where it talks about the plague of darkness. There the Torah says v'yomesh, v'yomesh choshech, that the plague of darkness could be felt. It was tangible, it could be felt. And the Ibn Ezra writes that when I was in Londres, the fog or the smog of London could be felt, and this is what the Bible meant, that the darkness was tangible. So from here we know that if, in fact, he did cross over to England. He is mainly known, however, for his commentary on the entire Tanakh. Very few people wrote a commentary on the entire Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, on the whole thing. Ibn Ezra was one of them. In fact, not only did he write a commentary on the entire Tanakh, he wrote over 100 books on secular subjects as well, on mathematics and astronomy, some of which we have, some of which we do not have, some of which he only writes references to. And all this was done, if you want, whilst travelling on the way. And it is quite phenomenal that today we have, in fact, we have all of his commentary on the Tanakh still intact. Any edition of the commentaries of the Tanakh will have the commentary of the Ibn Ezra in it. He wrote his commentary much according to pshat, the simple meaning of the verse. He was extremely particular about Jewish grammar, and in places gave mystical but cryptic interpretations of the Bible which he was writing on. Tradition has it, age 75, in the year 1167, he was killed al Kiddush Hashem by the Crusaders. Al Kiddush Hashem means sanctifying God's name, in one of the Crusades. The Ibn Ezra was killed by the Crusaders, and that is how the life of one of the greatest writers whose writings still influence today ended. So we've looked at three people so far: Rabbi Yitzchok Alfasi, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra. However, tonight, more than anybody else, I wanted to focus on two people. However, I think we're only at the end of the day going to speak about one of them, and next week we'll have to come on to the second. Tonight we're going to start and finish with Maimonides, with the Rambam. Rambam is an acronym for, the Resh stands for Rabbeinu, Mem stands for Moshe, Bet stands for Ben, and Mem stands for Maimon. Rabbeinu, Moshe, our teacher Moshe, Ben Maimon, the son of Maimon. Maimon is an interesting name. We don't find, we find very few people, or very few Jewish people that are called Maimon. In fact, it's not a common Jewish name at all. However, we'll soon see who his father was. But before we even say anything about Rambam, we have to quote the quote that is written on his grave. Anybody who's been to the city of Tiberias in Israel should or would have gone to visit the grave of Maimonides, and the inscription on his grave is Mimoshe ad Moshe loikom kamoshe. From Moses to Moses, there was none like Moses. Of course, he didn't write that inscription. It was written as perhaps a testimony to the greatness of this sage who, as we'll soon see, really replicated the Torah which Moses gave. The Rambam was born on Erev Pesach in the year 1135 in Cordoba in Spain. I'm sure his mother appreciated that, being born Erev Pesach, the day before Pesach. I'm sure all ladies who give birth on that day, it's not exactly the best day in the Jewish calendar to have a baby boy. However, she was consoled by the fact that this was to become one of the greatest. Perhaps if you're born Erev Pesach, you're destined to be one of the greatest. In fact, the Maharal of Prague, the great Rabbi Yehuda Lowy of Prague, was also born, actually not on Erev Pesach, he was born on Seder night. Which is even more exciting. In fact, they say about him that as he was born on Seder night, he saved the Jewish town from a blood libel. The story goes that there was a non-Jew who was carrying a dead Christian child to be placed in his father's house to make a blood libel on that night, and as he was walking down the street with a sack with this dead child in, it was on the Seder night, and Mrs., the mummy of the Maharal, went into labor, and somebody was sent immediately to run out of the house and go and find the doctor. And the fellow ran out of the house to go and find the doctor, and the goy who was carrying the sack thought that he was chasing after him, so he started running away. He bumped into a policeman. The policeman asked him what was in his sack, and a blood libel was foiled. So it says that the Maharal of Prague, that he foiled a blood libel even before he was actually born. And those who know the story, that's why he created the Golem of Prague, in order to save the Jews of Prague from blood libels. Perhaps we'll talk about him when we talk about the Jews of Prague. The famous Rabbi Yehuda Lowy of Prague, also born on Erev Pesach. Let's come back to Rambam. His father, Maimon, in fact was of Davidic descent. He was a direct descendant of Judah the prince, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who could trace his lineage all the way back to King David. So he really was of royal descent. His father, Maimon, was a dayan, a judge, in the city of Cordova. However, when Maimonides was only 13 years of age, it was then that the Almohades conquered the city of Cordova in 1148, and they gave the Jews the choice either of conversion or a compulsion to flee, or worse. And for 10 years, the family of Maimon wandered around almost like nomads from one place to the other, and without finding a place to rest their feet. They eventually, in 1159, came to Fez in North Africa, but again, could only stay there for 5 years because of fanatic religious persecution. Interesting that from Fez in North Africa, they traveled directly to Israel, crossing the Mediterranean. Maimonides went through the land of Israel together with his father. They visited Yerushalayim and Hebron, and in fact he prayed at the Kotel and also at the tomb of the patriarchs in Hebron. They couldn't settle there. However, they moved down from the land of Israel to Fostat, which was near Cairo in Egypt. And it is there, in Fostat, that the family of Maimonides settled. Tragically, a few months after his family arrived in Fostat, Maimon, Rambam's father, passed away. And the truth is, this was a great tragedy for the Rambam, because all through their travels, and in his early years, it was Maimon, the father of the Rambam, who had been his principal teacher. And we will soon learn that in those travels, Maimonides managed to author numerous works as he was being chased from place to place on a ship or on dry land. He managed to author tremendous works even on the run, as we'll soon see. Unfortunately, a few months after, as I said, he arrived in Fostat, his father passed away, and he had a brother called David. And David supported the family. He in fact was a jewel merchant, and David, the brother of the Rambam, travelled to India to import jewels from India. There was a trade, India, north India and Egypt, like a trade route. However, a short while later, David, the brother of the Rambam, also unfortunately drowned in a storm in an Indian Ocean, and the entire family fortune was lost with him. And therefore Maimonides was forced to take up a profession. Until then, he had been supported by his family. Now it's interesting, there is an interesting discussion as to whether a rabbi, a teacher, may make his living out of teaching Torah. Now this is an interesting discussion. In fact, Rambam was of the opinion that a rabbi is not allowed to take any form of payment whatsoever for issuing legal instruction, for teaching. He must do it because it is a vocation, it's a call. Where's he going to get paid from? He has to have a business. He must go out to earn a living. Others disagreed. And we do know nowadays that we don't follow Maimonides' opinion in this, and that we do employ rabbis and dayanim and so on and so forth. However, once Maimonides' opinion was that once he couldn't be supported by his family, he needed to enter a profession. So he entered into medicine. And he worked his way up in the medical profession. So much so, he was such a great doctor that he became the Sultan Saladin's personal physician. The physician to the vizier of the court, which was an unbelievable position in the land. It was a very prestigious position because he had contact with the Sultan. He had contact with all the governors of the land. And of course, Egypt then was an extremely important center of commerce and of trade, and from there he could have a tremendous impact, not only the Jews in Egypt, but all around the world. At the age of 42, the community of Cairo appointed Maimonides as their chief rabbi. And I'd now like to go on to start telling you about the works which the Rambam produced. When he was aged 23, whilst fleeing from the fanatical sects that were chasing them, as I mentioned before, on both on land and in sea, Rambam wrote a work called the Pirush HaMishnayos. Now the Mishnah was written by Yehuda HaNasi. The Rambam, however, wrote a commentary on the Mishnah. Now let me just tell you, ladies and gentlemen, all Maimonides' works, bar one, his main one, the Mishnah Torah, were written in Arabic. The commentary on the Mishnah was written in Arabic, and it was a tremendous commentary. Even today, it is appended to all versions of the Mishnah, and in it, in a very concise and clear way, Maimonides explains the fundamental principles behind each Mishnah. There are, however, certain sections of that commentary to the Mishnah which are extremely important to us today, and they are the following. His Hakdama, his introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah, is very, very important, because in it he traces the entire development of the oral tradition. Even today, if you wanted to study, if you needed to give somebody a text to study, how did Jewish law evolve? How did it come into being? From the word go, from Moses, till Jewish law, till the Maimonides days, how did it evolve? The best text to study is the introduction of Maimonides to his commentary on the Mishnah. It starts off by telling you how Moses received the Torah on Mount Sinai, how he gave it over to Joshua, how there were Shivim Zakenim, there were 70 elders, how they gave it over to generation, from which generation to which, and enumerates the generations, tells them who was the leaders in each generation, until the days, the 40 generations until Judah the prince. Then it tells you how he wrote the Mishnah, then it tells you about the Talmud, and so on and so forth. It's an unbelievable introduction to Jewish law. Of course, it's been translated into English and many other languages. In the 10th chapter of the tractate Sanhedrin means the Jewish court, in the 10th chapter of tractate Sanhedrin, Maimonides there, in his commentary on the Mishnah, goes through the most basic fundamental beliefs of Judaism. And in fact, that, and from there was formulated the 13 Anima Amins, the 13 principles of faith of Maimonides, which are now appended to most Siddurim. When you open a Siddur, usually at the end of the Shacharit prayer, at the end of the morning prayer, you'll find an appendix. Appended is the 13 principles of faith by Maimonides, starting off with Anima Amin, I believe. And this was a revolutionary idea in his day. Before that, nobody had said that there are fundamental principles of Judaism. In fact, I'll let you into a secret, others disagreed with the Rambam. There are others who said that there are, for example, in the Sefer Ikarim, written by Rabbi Yosef Albert, it says that there are only three main principles of Jewish faith. It was Maimonides who asserted that there were 13, and these have been universally accepted, printed, as I said, in all Siddurim. However, where will you find them developed in his work? In his commentary on the Mishnah. His introduction to the ethics of the fathers, Pirkei Avot, is also a very important introduction. It's called Shemona Prokim, 8 sections. And there he gives a wide-ranging overview of Jewish ethics and good character traits. So, in his commentary of the Mishnah, certain sections of it have been popularized and today widely quoted. He wrote other works at the time, earlier works, some on astronomy, some on mathematics, and we'll soon see later many on medicine. But that's the works on medicine came later in his life, of course, when he was already became famed as a great physician. Let me, however, now focus on his main work. Age 32, Maimonides started work on a book which he called the Mishnah Torah. Now, what does the word Mishnah mean for example, on Shabbat, we all have lechem mishneh, double bread. We have two challahs on the table. Why do we have two challahs on the table? Because a double portion of manna fell on Friday in the wilderness. So, in order to remind us of the double portion of manna which fell on Friday, we have two challahs on the table on Friday night. So mishneh means double, or a repetition of, huh? Secondary, yes, like for example, the viceroy to the king in Egypt, Joseph, was called a mishneh lemelech. Absolutely, he was called secondary to the king. Perhaps we could also use the word revision. In other words, the book Mishneh Torah was a revision of the laws of the Torah. And let me tell you what he did. We started off this evening by talking about how the Talmud is a bit of a no-go area for a layman, although today the study of Talmud has become tremendously popularized. However, in order to study the entire Talmud, even if you study at a pace of one page a day, it will take you 7 years. That cycle is called Daf Hayomi, one page a day, and there are over 100,000 participants today living in the Jewish world who study a page of the Talmud, one page a day. It's a very popular thing to do. But it takes 7 years to get through. And even if you've been through it once, most Jews, if you ask them where are, for example, the laws of mezuzah in the Talmud, they would not be able to tell you, unless somebody's actually been through the Talmud. Because it's not systematic. There was a certain system in Talmud, but it wasn't written in certainly the Talmud wasn't written in a very systematical way. The Rif helped us because he summarized the law. Instead of having to decide the law from all the disputes yourself, you had the law summarized. But Maimonides diverted from that. And he did something very, very radical. And I'd like to read you his introduction to the I'd like to read you his introduction to his book, to the Mishneh Torah. The Rambam writes the following: at this time, meaning his own time, the sufferings of our people have increased. The pressing need of the moment supersedes every other consideration. The wisdom of the wise has vanished, and the wisdom of our learned men is concealed. Hence the commentaries, compilation of laws, and responsa of the Gaonim. Now the Gaonim, if you remember, were the great Jewish leaders of Babylon, which they thought were easy to understand, have in our times become difficult to understand, and there are only a few individuals who are able to comprehend them properly. And it is even more so with regard to the Talmud, both the Babylonian and the Palestinian, as well as the Sifra and the Sifri and the Tosefta. Those are additional books which were written on the scriptures, all of which require a broad mind, great intelligence, and considerable study. And only then can one know the right path with regard to what is forbidden or permitted, as well as the other laws of the Torah. For this reason, I, Moshe ben Maimon the Sephardi, and all the Sephardim underline that, he was called Ramosha, he said, Ani Moshe ben Maimon ha-Sephardi. In fact, just as in parenthesis, it says in last week's Sedra, Ubnei Yisrael, that the Jewish people went out of Egypt, the Yad Roma, with a high hand. So the word Roma is spelt Resh Mem He. And here is a hint to Maimonides in the Torah, because it says the Jews went out of Egypt with Yad. We'll soon see that the book which Rambam wrote was called the Yad. Rama stands for Resh, Reb, Mem, Moshe, He, Hasfardi. Rabbeinu Moshe Hasfardi. I, Moshe ben Maimon the Sfardi, have girded my loins and relying on the help of the Almighty, blessed be He, have thoroughly studied all their works, and decided to compile the results derived from them as to what is prohibited and what is permitted, what is clean and what is unclean, and all the other laws of the Torah, all in clear language and concise style, so that the entire oral Torah will be systematically arranged for all. I shall not quote the questions and answers or the difference of opinions discussed, but only the laws themselves in a clear and succinct manner, in accordance with the conclusions derived from all these treatises and compilations existing since the time of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi until the present day, so that all the laws shall be accessible to young and old, whether they are biblical precepts or enactments by the sages or prophets. In short, my purpose in composing this code is that no man shall have any need to resort to any other book on any matter of Jewish law, but that this compendium contain the entire oral law, including the ordinances, customs, and decrees instituted from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu to the redaction of the Talmud, and as expounded for us by the Gaonim in all their works composed by them since the completion of the Talmud. Therefore, I called this work Mishneh Torah, the second law to the Torah, for a man should first read the written law and then read this code, and he will know from it the entire oral law without the need of reading any other book between them. Now, I don't think you realize what the impact of such a statement like that was. In short, he's saying, all you need to do is read the Chumash and read my book and you've got everything. That was greeted in exuberance, and people were ecstatic on the one hand. Certainly the masses, now they had a book, access to Jewish law without the, well, I say this and he says that, and what about this and what about that, and 10 different opinions. You just had the law, exactly what you should do. He didn't quote any of the discussion. He didn't give any source material. He didn't make it difficult. It was written in clear, concise Hebrew. It was written in an international language. It was written so that a child can understand it. The Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, instituted a few years ago that we should study Maimonides. If you study it 3 chapters a day, you finish it in 1 year. And if you study it 1 chapter a day, you finish the book in 3 years. I undertook this cycle of study and have in fact now completed Maimonides a number of times, the entire book Mishneh Torah, thank God. And it's a beautiful book. It is, there's no debate or dialogue. It's very clear and concise and gives you an overview of all compendium of Jewish law. Now, may I stress this point, law. It does not deal with history. It does not deal with all the beautiful stories of the Talmud, the anecdotes, the wisdom. It is purely a book of law and tells us what the halakha is. But if you want a summary of Jewish law, it's terrific. Other rabbis, of course, took a bit of exception to this, and they felt that the Maimonides would be now sidetracking the Talmud, and he would send the Talmud into almost becoming obsolete. We will soon come back to their opposition, because Maimonides wrote another work which in fact caused more of a storm than his Mishneh Torah did. Suffice it to say that the book Mishneh Torah, which was written in 14 sections, and that's why it's called the Yad HaChazaka. Yad in Hebrew means the hand. Yud, there's 2 letters in the word Yad, a Yud and a Dalet. Numerically, Yud is 10, Dalet is 4, 10 and 4 is 14. Since the book has 14 sections, it's called the Yad. And it's wonderfully systematic. If you want to know where the laws of mezuzahs are, it's quite clear. You look in the laws of mezuzah. It starts off by Hilchas Yisod HaTorah, the laws of the foundation of the Torah. It then goes on to the laws of Deis, the opinions of men. Then it goes on to the holiday laws, the Shabbat laws, the laws of Pesach. Everything is very systematic, and it's written in chapters. He enumerates the mitzvahs, the commandments, which you need to know about them, and it's a terrific book. And in fact, as I said to you, Joseph Cairo, when he wrote his Code of Jewish Law, based it very much on Maimonides. One thing Maimonides did again, which was something quite novel, he summarized the entire range of Jewish law, even Jewish law which is not applicable nowadays. Now, the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchok Alfasi, didn't do that. When he summarized Jewish law, he summarized only what was important nowadays, when we do not have a temple. Maimonides did not do that. He summarized the entire Jewish law. So, in fact, the book of the Mishnah Torah will even be in use when Mashiach comes. When, in fact, all Torah law will be reinstituted, we will have a book, which is really why it's eternal in its usage. We'll have a book with the entire compendium of Jewish law, rather than just having a code for the Jew in exile. There is a tradition that it took him 10 years to complete writing, which was a genius. It's genius to complete a work even in 10 years. However, there is a tradition that when he finished his work, he had a dream. And in the dream, his father, Maimon, and another man came to him, and he was told that this other man was Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu said to him, he examined the code, and he said to him in the dream, Yeyasha Koyach, he said, well done, a work well done. So, if you want, that even Moshe Rabbeinu himself gave his approbation to the work of Maimonides. The work was copied and sent to all Jewish major centers. In fact, rich Jews had whole, I suppose, I don't know what they're called, they weren't called printing houses, scribe houses perhaps, as they were called, place houses full of scribes that would simply sit and copy books and in handwriting and send them all over the place. There was no printing, this is way before printing. However, the manuscripts of Rambam we have today, we even have a lot of it in his original handwriting. We do have Maimonides' original handwritten excerpts of his handwritten works. It's interesting to note that certain passages of his work were censored by different censors later when they started printing it, particularly the Christian censors. And one thing which is fascinating is that right at the end of his work, in the Laws of Kings, he in fact makes reference to Christianity, which was censored in areas where the Christian censor was in operation. But recently a manuscript of Maimonides' Mishnah Torah was found in Yemen, which of course was an Arab land which was not censored, and there we find that they in fact left this portion in. Suffice it to say, though, that after the Mishnah Torah was written, it was widely distributed, and Maimonides' fame as a leader, an undisputed, in fact, halachist, beyond all question, became very world famous. There were some that didn't like the work again because he didn't create footnotes. He didn't give references to any of his decisions. In fact, it was only later that Joseph Cairo himself, the author of the Code of Jewish Law himself, wrote a book called the Kesef Mishnah, meaning double silver, or if you want a commentary on the Mishnah Torah, footnoting everything which Maimonides had ever said. Suffice it to say, though, that in that eminent or preeminent position of being a world leader in Jewry, now he was faced with the prospect of not only being the physician to the Sultan, but also of being the center to which Jews all around the world would address their questions. And Jews did. They sent him very difficult questions, and he had to respond. Originally, they were lengthy responsa. However, the vast majority of the extant responsa that we had from Maimonides is very short, due to his amazingly heavy schedule. Sometimes it's just even a few words. But we do have a few letters epistles of Maimonides which became classics. One of them was called the Igeres Hashmad, which literally translated means an epistle concerning apostasy. Now, you've heard of the Maranos, and we'll discuss them later when we get to the Spanish Inquisition. However, the Maranos of the Spanish Inquisition were not the first Maranos. Jews in certain Arabic states were then forced either to convert to Islam or to die. And some of them went underground. They became the first. A Marano, I believe, is a Spanish word. I'm not sure what the Arabic word for a Marano is, a hidden Jew. However, due to proselytization by the Almohades, this fanatic sect, a lot of Jews went underground. And there was a question of their status. Do you know, a Jew who professes public to be a Muslim and keeps Judaism in private, so what is he? Can you give him an aliyah? Can he become part of the Jewish community? Can he marry somebody Jewish? How do you know? And there were serious questions asked. And the Rambam wrote a letter called the Igeres Hashmad, an epistle of apostles, discussing the status of these Islamic Maranos. Another one of his famous epistles was called the Igeres Taimon, the letter to Yemen. Now, the problems of the Jews in Yemen were threefold. Number one, there was a fanatical Muslim cleric who became the ruler in Yemen, and he decreed a conversion decree on all the Jews in Yemen. Either convert or die. The second thing was that there was a Jewish apostate who embraced Islam and, in fact, preached to the Jews in Yemen that Islam had superseded Judaism. Yes, Judaism was right. It's all very good, but now there's a new thing. And this new thing, Islam has superseded Judaism. And the third thing they had an imposter who proclaimed himself a Mashiach, who said that he was the Mashiach. And there was a Jew in Yemen called Rabbi Yaakov al-Fayumi, and he wrote a letter to the Rambam asking the Rambam to give direction to the Yemenite Jewish community as what should they do in this most difficult hour. What should the Jews of Yemen do under such circumstances? And he wrote back this letter in which he traces the roots of anti-Semitism and says that it's due to envy of the Jews being the chosen people and the enemies of the Jews unable to do battle with God himself treat the situation by doing battle with his people. They employ three basic methods. Number one, brute force or extermination. Number two, they try to refute Judaism. Or number three, they make false claims of new religions. The Rambam in his epistle to Yemen urges the people to remain faithful, and eventually he used his influence as the personal physician in the court, he used his influence by the Sultan to prevent the persecution of the Jews in Yemen, to intervene on their behalf. And in fact, an amazing thing happened. The Rambam was successful. This was an unbelievable example in the 12th century of international intervention by a prominent Jew, which was successful, and the suppression and oppression of the Jews in Yemen stopped. So much so that they honored the Rambam in the following way. Kaddish had become, of course, a very important part of the prayers. Now, Kaddish starts, Yiskadal v'Yiskadash Shmei Rabbah, in the name, great name of God, be exalted and glorified. Ba'ol Madiv Rochi Rusei, in the world which created according to his will. Yamlich Malchusei, and may his kingdom be established. b'chayeichoin, in our lives, uv'yoymeichoin, and in your lives, uv'chaye, the whole Beis Yisrael, and in the lives of all the house of Israel. Yes? Well, the Jews of Yemen added on a few words, b'chayeichoin, in our lives, uv'yoymeichoin, and in your lifetime, and in the lifetime of the entire house of Yisrael, uv'chaye Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon. And in the lifetime of Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon, said he added in his name to the Kaddish. That was the great esteem which the Jews of Yemen had for the Rambam, and that was their way of showing appreciation for his intervening on their behalf. So that was a great letter, the Igeres Tema. By the way, all these letters are printed both Hebrew and English and are still available. The next book of which the Rambam wrote caused the greatest controversy. He wrote a book called Moire Nevuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed. Now, it must be said, today, perhaps, if you would read the book, you would become more perplexed than guided. And some people had the claim to his book even then. Let us say that the people of his time were influenced by Greek philosophers whose works had been translated into Arabic. Remember that all these letters, including the book of Moreh Nevuchim, were all written in Arabic. The only work Rambam wrote in Hebrew was the Mishneh Torah, but all the other works were written in Arabic for the people of his day. Moreh Nevuchim was written to, if you want, re-establish the preeminence of Jewish philosophy in the eyes of the masses who were studying at this time Aristotle as was translated into Arabic. In other words, Greek philosophers had permeated and their ideas had influenced the Jewish community, and Rambam felt that it was necessary for him to elucidate many concepts in a philosophical and rational manner. So, for example, we have one idea which everybody is perplexed with. One of the principles of our faith is that God is incorporeal. He doesn't have a body nor a form of body. And yet, in the Bible, God is described in human terms. And God saw, and God got angry, and God heard, and so on and so forth. And Maimonides deals with this subject in Moreh Nevuchim. Within a decade of its being written, two Hebrew translations of Moreh Nevuchim were made, one made by a man called Rav Shmuel Ibn Tibbon, of whom we'll speak about shortly, and the other made by Rabbi Huda Al-Kharizi. In fact, Maimonides himself saw the translation of Rav Shmuel Ibn Tibbon and praised it highly. You know what I'd like to do at this moment? I'd like perhaps to divert from Maimonides. I'll come back to the Moreh Nevuchim in a minute, but just let me tell you about the Tibbon family. And in order to do that, we've got to jump out of Egypt and go right to the other side of Europe, to southern France, because at this very same time of Maimonides in living in Egypt, you had in southern France a big community of Jewish scholars growing. And they'd moved at this time from Spain over to southern France. And if you think about it, southern France, if you go over the Pyrenees, southern France is really the crossroads between Spain, France, Germany, and Italy. And that little area of southern France was then called province, provincia, however you say it. The cities of Marseille, Narbonne, Montpellier, and Lunel were all great Jewish centers in the 11th and the 12th centuries. In fact, that area became, if we want to look at it in historical terms, the bridge between the Arab-influenced Jewish communities of Spain and North Africa and the European communities in France and Germany. And that's why they had great translators, such as the Tibbon family. I say the Tibbon family because the father was a man called Yehuda ibn Tibbon. He translated Emunas Vedeas of Rav Sadia Goyen, a great philosophical work of Rav Sadia Goyen. We spoke about that previously. He translated Rabbeinu Bachaya's work of the Chovas Halavavis, the Duties of the Heart, another book we've talked about. And he also translated the Kuzari, which we've spoken about tonight, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's work, all from Arabic into Hebrew. So now these works were all available in Hebrew in the communities of France and Germany who did not speak Arabic. The spoken language of the Jews had changed to French or German. His son, Reb Shmuel ibn Tibbon, was called, in fact, the father of all translators, and he translated this guide to the perplexed. The Chachmei Provencia, the wise sages of Provence, which was this area of southern Spain, in fact, southern France, the southern France, created a revolution in their own terms of writing. Just to mention one other great sage who in fact came from that area, he was called Reb David Kimchi. I'm sure you've heard of there's a Rabbi Kimchi in London. The Kimchi family is a very illustrious family. There's a saying in the Ethics of the Father, in Ein Kemach, Ein Torah. If there's no flour, there's no Torah, which means if you don't have anything to eat, you can't study. So they in fact refer this to the Kemach or the Kimchi family. Without the Kimchis, who would have Torah? Because one of the great commentaries written on the Bible was written by a man called Rabbi David Kimchi, otherwise known as the Radak. If you've ever studied Tanakh, you will study it with the commentary of Rashi, Ibn Ezra, and Radak. Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, wrote this beautiful Pirush on the Tanakh. He also wrote a Michlul, an early dictionary, and very important, he wrote a book called Teshuvas Lanotzrim, a refutation of Christian ideology, which then, of course, was a tremendous thing to write, very brave thing to write, and in fact highlights to us how much the great sages had to debate then their Christian contemporaries. And we'll speak about that a little bit later. Just an interesting thing, the King James's translation of the Bible was very much influenced by Rabbi David Kimchi's commentary on the Bible. So in fact the King James's version follows much of the Radak's translation. Now I just want to tell you that the sages of Provence supported up to the hilt Maimonides, and you'll see why in a minute. Let's go back to the Morin Nevuchim. For 100 years after the Maimonides wrote this book, long after he'd in fact passed away, there was a tremendous conflict in Jewish literary circles about the book Morin Nevuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed. The critics of the book didn't agree with Maimonides' approach to subject divine wisdom of the Torah to rational philosophy. They criticized him for rationalizing every mitzvah. Now specifically they single him out for one. Maimonides writes in Morin Nevuchim that the sacrifices which were brought in the temple and previously in the tabernacle were a concession to an idolatrous mentality. In other words, since the people in the land of Canaan were idolaters and they had sacrifices, therefore as a concession God said, you can offer sacrifices, however it must be to God. Now they come down very heavy on Maimonides for this, because the critics say no, that's not the reason why God ordered the sacrifices, and specifically said in the Bible it's because it's to make a reach nichoyach l'Hashem. There's all sorts of different reasons given for sacrifices, but Maimonides in the book Morin Nevuchim was, if you want, hell bent on giving rational interpretations to every mitzvah. furthermore, he gave certain allegorical exegesis of certain narratives in the Bible. He exercised restraint in that, in allegoric interpretation. However, let it be said that in the second half of the 13th century, there was a tremendous controversy over allegoric interpretation of the Bible, because if you take it to an extreme, you can in fact go to an extreme and say that the biblical narrative never took place. It's all quite simply a poetic, allegoric form of describing certain things. So, for example, some people said that Abraham and Sarah were never two biblical figures, they were just examples of form and matter. Yitzchak and Rivka were description of active and passive intellect. The 12 sons of Jacob were the 12 constellations. And if you wanted to, you could really misinterpret the entire Bible in an allegoric way, rejecting its simple meaning. And in fact, there was a great sage called Rashba, Rabbeinu Shlomo ben Aderet, who in fact placed a ban on all those people who studied philosophy and allegoric interpretation of the Bible in the way that was suggested by the extremists, because they were in fact, it was leading them up the religious creek, in the sense that they weren't taking the biblical text and narrative as in its simple form as we have always we've always received it. Now, this conflict between traditional Talmudists and rationalists escalated. Some communities banned the Moreh Nevuchim, and a ban was accepted in most of France on it. It's fascinating that the Rambam was living in Egypt, but they banned his book in France. The Radak, Rav David Kimchi, and all the great scholars of province backed Maimonides, and they defended him in any way that they could. There was a man called Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, who was a mixture between, in fact, he was a great Talmudist and also a great mystic, and combined the two. And he offered somewhat of a compromise, but always showed allegiance and support to Rambam. At the height of the conflict, there was a certain man called Rav Shlomo of Montpellier. He denounced the Moreh Nevuchim to the local authorities. He went, he did a very smart move. He denounced the Jewish book to the non-Jewish authorities of the day, and said that it was to the Christian authorities, and said that this book could, God forbid, lead to rejection of basics of the Bible, and in fact, enforced by civil powers, the books of Maimonides were burnt publicly in Montpellier and Paris in the year 1234. So you can see the extent to which there was some opposition to it. There was a storm of protest. Ishra Shlomo was condemned. First of all, you don't bring dirty Jewish washing into public. Just we have an inner conflict, and you don't go outside and tell people about it. The son of the Rambam, his only heir, a man called Reb Avram, wrote a book called Milchamos Hashem, The Wars of God, where he defends his father and he supports his father and shows what a great tzaddik, what a great man he was, and so on and so forth. However, I must say that today, apart from in a very few circles, perhaps in the libraries of Cambridge where they study philosophy and the halls of Jewish College where if you're taking a degree on philosophy, I would say those are the only places where Moreh Nevuchim, where the Guide to the Flex, is studied today. Otherwise, it's still today considered a little taboo in Jewish circles. Go to the other book of Maimonides, Mishneh Torah, and it has a most eminent place, a tremendous place in Jewish law, in the sense that all great Jewish rabbis considered their greatest teacher to be Maimonides, and many rabbis devoted themselves wholeheartedly to explaining minutiae of the Rambam and devoted hundreds and thousands of books on commentaries of the Rambam and so on and so forth. Today, Jewish philosophy, this debate which I mentioned before, and between the traditional approach and the philosophical rational approach, that debate still burns today. And I think today, because of the mishmash of ideas, you have somewhat of a compromise. So for example, if we wanted to talk about the proof of the authenticity of the Jewish religion, any rabbi who today is giving a lecture on it will approach it from both ways. In other words, he'll give a presentation of the authenticity of Judaism based on tradition, that there was a stand at Sinai and God gave us the Torah and we are the bearers of the Torah, and will demonstrate how and why through this course, through the course of Jewish history, we have studied in depth from the moment go, from Adam even, until today. We've seen its development. That is a traditional approach. And then you can have a philosophical, rational approach, and I think that you must combine the two today in order to give an all-rounded approach. In his latter years, he was headhunted, Maimonides, unsuccessfully, by an Englishman. Richard the Lionheart wanted to headhunt the Rambam to come and be placed in Harley Street somewhere, but he didn't. He didn't manage to. I think Rambam decided to stay in sunny Egypt, where he was appointed the Nogid, the supreme head of Egyptian Jewry. He wrote 15 treatises on medicine, on poisons. The Rambam was a genius on poisons and its treatments. My children know umpteen stories of how the other courtiers at the court of the Saladin tried to catch the Rambam out on certain treatments to certain poisons. He wrote a treatise on asthma. He wrote a book on hygienic regulations in order to stay healthy, and he also wrote a very interesting work on optimum diet, and he says that if you will keep to this diet, I will guarantee you that you will never get ill, and if you do get ill, then it's because you're not keeping to the diet. I'm sure, have you ever heard that beforehand? Close to the age of 70 in the year 1204, he died in Fostat. Well, the truth is, he died of another thing. I think it could be said that Maimonides died, perhaps not because of diet, my teacher, I had a great teacher. He said that I've never sinned, not because I've never had a desire to do so. He said I just haven't had time. I think the same could be said of Maimonides. He was simply overburdened and overloaded, both with his duties. He writes in one of his responsa that he gets up in the morning, from the morning to the evening he's at the court of the Saladin, and he had to deal with public affairs. When he got home, he had a private surgery till late at night. Late at night, he then used to sit down and review his halachic works and answering the responsa, and he kept a schedule. Then he had communal affairs to deal with. He kept a schedule which, for any mortal, if I can use that word, one of us, would be an astounding schedule, and he probably died, you know, because he was really overburdened. He died in Foster. He was publicly mourned for 3 days, and he was buried, not in Egypt, but his body was buried, and he was carried to Tiberia. Why Tiberias? There is a tradition, Maimonides writes in one of his books, that upon the resurrection, when Mashiach will come, it says that the Sanhedrin, the supreme Jewish court, will be reconvened. However, just as in the destruction of the temple, when it was displaced from the temple courts, it travelled to 10 different places in its exile, it says it will come back through those 10 places back to Jerusalem. Now, the last place ever that the Sanhedrin was convened was in the city of Tiberias. And therefore Maimonides' will was that he be buried there, so that when Mashiach would come, he too would be in that Sanhedrin. And I think that, although it's a tradition, is perhaps the greatest tribute, because he was such he contributed so much to Jewish law and to Jewish thinking, even today in medical terms, in medicine terms, his books are quoted, but his major contribution must be the Mishneh Torah, the source of the Shulchan Aruch, of the Code of Jewish Law, and his philosophical works. This was one of the great luminaries of Judaism, who accomplished so much in such a short lifetime. There's a beautiful idea that when we refer to Moses, we refer to him as Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, our teacher. When we refer to Maimonides, we call him Rabbeinu Moshe, our teacher Moses. And often it's been asked, why is that so? Moshe should be called Rabbeinu Moshe. After all, you put the word rabbi before the name. Whereas Maimonides, who came much later, should be called Moshe Rabbeinu. Many explanations. Somebody once had a very simple pshat, is that we're so familiar with Moshe, with Moses of the Bible, he's already Moshe. He got to know the rabbi already, you know. Till you get to know the rabbi, he's Rabbi Moshe. Once you get to know, he's Moshe, our rabbi. We've become so familiar with Moshe Rabbeinu, we know his whole story, and it's become such part of us, he's Moshe Rabbeinu. Others say that the word Moshe, why Moshe is an Egyptian name at the end of the day, it was given to Moshe by Pharaoh's daughter, and she called him Moshe ki min hamayim mishisihu, because Moshe was drawn out of the Nile. Now, grammatically, the word drawn out in Hebrew should be moshui. Moshe means the one who draws out. Not the one that was drawn out, but the one who draws out. Since it was Moshe who took us out of Egypt, therefore we refer to him principally as Moshe. He was the one that took us out of Egypt. And yes, of course, he was the one that received the Torah. He was Rabbeinu. But first he was Moshe, and then Rabbeinu. Whereas when it comes to Maimonides, what did he give us? He gave us the law. He gave us his compendium. He gave us the Mishneh Torah. He gave us his book of Jewish law, which you could read the five books of Moses and then read his book and you'd have the whole range of Jewish law. So he referred to him as Rabbeinu Moshe, because his first achievement, his primary achievement, was that he was a teacher. Moshe la Moshe, lekom from Moshe, from Moses to Moses, there arose none like Moses. Next week, Amir Tashem, we will travel north to France, where we will look at another great Jewish person, Rashi, and his school, and we'll look at the Jews of France and the history of the Jews of France, and also start seeing how the Jews now started moving east to Germany and working our way towards the period of the 12th to the 15th centuries, and seeing that period of history. Good evening, it's been a pleasure.